welcome to the OnFit podcast, a weekly podcast on global economic development from some of the world's leading commentators. My name is Danai Kirakopoulou. I'm Chief Economist and Director of Research here at OnFit, and it's my pleasure to welcome to today's episode Sami Shah, Chief Economist at Lombard Odier. Welcome, Sami.
Hello, Danai. Thanks so much for having me.
So today's episode is in our Ahead of the ECB series, and we'll be talking about the ECB's April monetary policy decision. So we've seen recently the ECB turning more onto the dovish side. There is a more complicated macroeconomic environment. The past years have all been very uncertain, risks on the downside, but now we're seeing those intensified. We are seeing uncertainty over Brexit. We're now in April, and we still don't have clarity over the scenario. We're seeing trade tensions. We're seeing the global macroeconomic outlook already quite tilted on the downside in terms of risk. So what do you think of the ECB's turn to dovishness? It had only just started QE and scaling back monetary stimulus. Now they're coming back again with new instruments, again bringing the TLTROs and sending more dovish signal. Is it worth it? Will they have more space in the next downturn to use? Or was the risk of tightening too big to bear for the ECB? What's your assessment?
I would say that, yes, indeed, the ECB has reacted to the fact that the environment has taken a turn for the worse. And I would think in the fact that the environment has deteriorated in two phases, basically. Last year, although domestic demand remained relatively sound in terms of employment and wages, I would say domestically speaking, we had those country and sector-specific elements that kind of weakened the outlook. So obviously, the car industry in Germany, the Italian budget, or the Gilets jaunes in France, or even Brexit, I would say that, you know, was the first phase of the slowdown. But then came the second phase, which was more due to external factors, and you've mentioned it, particularly trade. And trade had a major impact on economies that were the most open and that tend to trade more. Obviously, the Eurozone is an open economy, but I'm thinking Japan and China or the rest of Asia as well. So this was a second hit. And I would say we're kind of in phase three now, which is there's been a persistent of either sector and country specific factors in Europe and then global factors. And now we're a bit in the doldrums here where things can recover, especially if trade recovers. But if we have another accident, either trade doesn't recover or maybe we get auto tariffs coming from the US, well, the persistence of factor obviously will start hitting confidence, and the domestic demand that has been so resilient for now in terms of employment and wages might basically taking a hit. So obviously for the ECB, they had to become much more prudent and therefore take a pause. What I would stress here is that because the trade disruption and the fact that we're in a global trade recession now, trying to exit that, but all major central banks of the planet have taken a turn for more accommodative monetary policy. So I wouldn't make this a specific European element and a specific element for the ECB. Obviously, the Fed has shifted as well. The Chinese authorities remained active. So has the BOG or even the Bank of England. So I would say because trade is so global, it led every major central bank of the planet to turn. And obviously, the ECB followed the crew, basically.
But at the same time, the ECB is in a different place than the Fed. The Fed started tightening much earlier. It is in a place to be able to cut if a downturn hits, which would be good to get your view as well. How likely you think that is in the case of the U.S. specifically? We're hearing difference in forecasts from simple slow downturn to even a recession over the next 12 to 24 months. So the Fed has started doing that. The ECB is in a very different place. Of course, it's an institution that has been slow to react in the past as well because it's a consensus-driven organization. You don't get the quick reaction that you have been able to get in the Fed and other central banks. It is also a matter of personalities, and it'd be good to discuss that as well, what happens when Mario Draghi leaves. But how do you compare the ECB to the Fed? You said we're all in the same boat, trade factors are global, but the central banks are very different positions.
You're right, and this comes down to the fact that, let's remember that the crisis in the US was mainly in 2008, whereas the double dip crisis basically in Europe went until 2012. So Europe is much younger, the Eurozone is much younger in its cycle when it just started to recover in 2013, whereas again in the US, the recovery started in 2009. So being younger in this cycle, there's a four-year gap basically between what the Fed was able to do following its crisis to what the ECB was able to do following its own crisis. Now again, if you take the Fed, it took 7 years for the US Federal Reserve to raise rates one time after putting rates to zero. So we had the crisis in 2008 and the first rate hike was in 2015. Well, apply that to Europe. The crisis was in 2012, 7 years from from now is 2019. And frankly, if it wasn't for the global trade disruption, well, the markets at some point were pricing a first rate hike in 2019. So I would say the ECB is not totally off the chart here when compared to the sequencing of events. Again, crisis, then a lot of unorthodox policies, and at some point you start to normalize. But again, making the calendar comparison to the US, the Fed started unwinding its QE in 2013 and then ending QE in 2014. So that is basically 5 and 6 years after the crisis. And it's been exactly the same sequence for the ECB. 5 or 6 years after the sovereign crisis, the ECB unwinded its QE and ended its QE in 2018. So I would say, you know, if it wasn't for the global trade disruption, the ECB would be on path to realize basically the same sequence of events the Fed has realized. Now, unlucky for the ECB, you get a global trade recession at the time when it's relatively young in its cycle. It was just initiating or trying to initiate a rate normalization. Will it happen? I don't know, but it is obviously very dependent on what happens to trade. I think we can make a scenario where if the Americans and the Chinese manage to come up with a trade deal that improves sentiment on the medium term, I think a lot of the activity will be recouped for the open economies. I'm thinking about Asia and Europe, and we could imagine the ECB being able to get back on track of its normalizing policy and eventually try to raise rates, maybe, who knows, once in 2020. So I would say that's not totally off considerations here.
Well, yes, that's one scenario, that Trump and China strike a deal and it's all better for world trade and the ECB is able to normalize again. The other scenario is Trump strikes a deal with China, but then who's next on his radar? Is it Europe? Is it Germany? The next country with a big surplus? So maybe it could become even worse for Europe if China is off the radar. But I wanted to pick up on what you said about Europe being younger in the cycle of the recovery. Is it a matter of younger? Is that a transitory issue? Is it a matter of time with the dovish measures and the accommodative policy of the ECB that the Europe follows the recovery cycle that we've seen in the US and elsewhere? Are there more structural factors going on? How do we ensure that we do indeed see a credible and long-standing recovery in euro area? Because it's not all down to just monetary policy. We have other policy levers, structural reforms, fiscal policy. How do you see the outlook there in terms of supporting the recovery and ensuring that the task of the ECB is supported by other factors as well?
I would say in terms of dealing with the crisis, the ECB didn't do much than just basically copying what the Fed has been doing following the subprime crisis. So again, the sequence of events is close to the same. The tools used are more or less the same, even if they were a bit innovative as well in Europe. But globally, dealing with the crisis, it's been about expanding the balance sheet and maintaining monetary policy looser for longer, allowing for some portfolio flows. And so it's been the same logic. And then unemployment came down, the output gap started closing, and obviously disinflationary or deflationary forces started to stabilize, you very gradually start to normalize monetary policy. So I would say in the sequence of events following the crisis, it's a bit the same logic. Now, where the things are different is that indeed in Europe, you have probably a potential growth. So in terms of demography and in terms of productivity, that's even lower than the US, maybe more, I wouldn't say comparable to Japan, but probably you have Japan on the low end in terms of potential growth. You have the US on the high end and probably Europe in the middle. So structurally speaking, Europe is obviously weaker, I would say, in that respect than the US. What does it mean? Well, it does mean that in a world where basically your ability to generate growth is not as strong as it used to be, you're going to keep monetary policy more accommodative for longer than what you used to be. But it's exactly the same with the US. Yes, they've been able to raise rates, but I would say compared to historical standards, US monetary policy is much more accommodative than in past cycles. So every central bank is in its own, I would say, set of assumptions in the same environment of slow potential following a major crisis. I would say the story is identical here. So as Japan probably wasn't and won't be able to raise rates or will have to maintain monetary policy, very accommodative one, maybe Europe can do a little bit more than Japan, and I would say the Fed can do a little bit more than the ECB. I would say this is how I see things structurally speaking.
Yes, of course, we're all in the same boat of low for longer and lower growth and the new normal and the secular stagnation hypothesis. But the question is, what happens when we do have cyclical shocks and we may have a downturn, as we talked in the beginning? What are the options for the ECB then? What can it do? It has expanded its toolbox over the past year. So those arguing that the toolbox is weaker now, that's one view. But of course, it's been strengthened because we've added new instruments. What else could they do? I mean, we've heard some hints for the tiering. TLTROs are coming back. What other options, in your view, that the ECB could use? And how do these play out also with the unintended, perhaps, consequences of quantitative easing? We're hearing more indications also of QE even being potentially contractionary at the margins because of the absence of collateral and the impact it's having also on bank profitability, impact on inequality, and so on. How do you see these trade-offs?
Sure, it's a very legitimate question. Obviously, when the ECB wasn't able to raise rates and we're living a cyclical downturn because of external factors, obviously comes to question, well, if that increases, if the risk increases, what will the ECB be able to do? They obviously haven't been able to raise rates, so they can't lower them that much. But I wouldn't worry too much on the toolkit of the ECB. I think if the lending channel is broken, if domestic conditions or deflationary forces were to come back again, I think the ECB can do a lot, to be fair. They can reignite QE, they can, if the lending channel is broken, they can do TLTROs with a negative rate, so finance basically the banks via quantitative easing to make sure that, I don't know, either they buy financial assets or make it conditional to the fact that they lend for mortgages so they can broaden the TLTROs. I think there is a lot that they can do. The problem is that in what's going on currently is that the weakness is externally driven. And I think that complicates the matter a lot because, you know, easier monetary policy can help when domestic demand is weak or again, when the lending channel is broken. But there is little evidence of that today. And in fact, Eurozone money growth has barely slowed despite the fact that they ended QE. So it has to be in an environment where monetary policy is more accommodative than in the past, in the sort of stagnation environment that you've described, you need a good combination of monetary policy and fiscal policy. And eventually, this is where there is an issue, both in the US, by the way, and in Europe. In the US, because they have been using a lot of fiscal policy so far, so if the downturn gets more severe, well, they have less leeway. But in Europe, we have leeway, especially in the economies that should be using it. I'm thinking Germany, obviously. But there is this dogma that they want to save it for the rainy days, even if the situation becomes critical. So I would say it has to be, think about Japan once again, it has to be a combination of monetary and fiscal policy. And this is really what lacks today in Europe. Monetary policy, the ECB wouldn't be able to do much in a context where the downturn is external and driven by trade. It has to be compensated by fiscal factors, more investment, or trying to improve eventually the potential of the economy via productive investment. So all this would a little bit more of fiscal leeway. And again, this is probably where we've been expecting that for a very long time. So all of those who have been expecting more fiscal space or the usage of that fiscal space in Europe have been disappointing over the years. But the countries with the most leeway are probably unwilling to use it and will be unwilling to use it until eventually things become much, much worse. But I would say the limit we have today is more on the fiscal side than on the monetary side.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up Germany and you think they will be saving the fiscal space for the rainy days. I mean, what are the rainy days? Germany very narrowly avoided technical recession at the end of 2018. There was negative growth in the third quarter and flat growth in the fourth quarter. Looking at the manufacturing data, the industrial production more recently, it's not looking like a very good picture for Germany. So if there was ever an incentive and a time to go into that fiscal space and the macroeconomic ammunition that exists in the euro area, it would probably be now, wouldn't you agree?
Couldn't agree more with you. So I would say, you know, with policy response likely to be absent when we think of the fiscal one or ineffective when we think of the monetary one in a context where issues are external, Europe, frankly, can only hope that world trade improves at some point and that any accidents are avoided. You mentioned that, you know, tariffs on European auto industry could come. Let's hope that doesn't happen and that basically the Americans and the Chinese are able to come up with a trade deal and trade flows recover and consequently, the manufacturing activity in Europe recovers. So I think this needs to be a base case. But if indeed it's not the case, well, there's going to be an issue on the fact that it's very unlikely that we have a policy response that should be coherent in this context.
It strikes me that we've been talking a lot about the ECB, we've been talking about the recovery, external demand, external factors, trade, fiscal policy. We haven't really mentioned inflation that much, and that is, of course, the ECB's primary mandate. So what is your view on the inflation outlook? Of course, it's very linked to the demand side of the economy that we've been talking about, the pace of the recovery, to the extent of the supply constraints gains as well in the structural factors and the global environment, but how do you see the ECB's mandate? Because there have also been calls, for example, to revisit the inflation targeting framework that the ECB operates under. Of course, that would open quite a can of worms with certain members wanting to see a higher target and others wanting to see a lower target. Do you see that as an area where we could see some creativity from the ECB going forward?
I'm not convinced. I think structurally we remain in an environment where inflation is contained by globalization factor, technology, aging populations, or excess leverage in the system. All these factors basically prevent sharp rise in structural inflation. So I think we remain in a regime where inflation remains relatively sticky and low. But nonetheless, cyclically, I'm not too worried about the direction of prices in Europe or even in the US for that matter. Domestic demand is still relatively robust. And as we've mentioned, you know, supported by growing employment, rising wages. There's little inflation when we think about headline inflation because oil prices are low. So there is strong purchasing power for households in Europe. And I think these are powerful and not particularly volatile drivers, which is why basically we place a great deal of emphasis on them. And I think the drivers basically would prevent a sharp slowdown in core inflation. And that should give comfort, I would say, to the ECB. But all that in a context where the structural regime of inflation remains relatively well contained, which is, by the way, a good thing. I think it's important for households in this environment where growth is low and there is a lot of inequalities that, you know, purchasing power and core inflation remains subdued.
Great. And let's think about the people behind those decisions. Mario Draghi's leaving the ECB later this year. How do you see the personalities makeup of the executive board affecting what we will see from the ECB in the future? We have also Benoît Cœuré, Peter Pratt stepping down and their mandates ending. We have potentially, if a German enters the executive board, then Sabine Lautenschläger would also have to step down because of the constraint on the nationality. How do you see this story affecting the ECB?
That's a very good point, Adanae, and I think it's an underestimated point. You said, does the ECB lack tools? We discussed that, and eventually my answer would be at this stage, no. But my worry around there is more the fact that we don't use the fiscal leeway that we have, that's one. But the second worry, I would say, which is on the monetary policy side this time and on the ECB, is the fact that, yes, indeed, the council is going to change. And the council matters a lot, the people matter a lot, and I think the president matters a lot. So we had a very bold set of people between Constantio, Peter Pratt, and obviously Mario Draghi that implemented very bold policy in times of crisis, but also, I would say, they've been relatively consistent throughout the year. And now, these people are going to change. And when we see how these people were different from the people before them, you see how important people are. And yes, indeed, I am a bit worried that with the new people coming in, so we'll see it will be Weidmann as the president. If it's not Weidmann, probably it will be another. So we can think about Olli Rehn or perhaps Liikanen, which are,
as a Frenchman, you're not very confident on the chances of Leroy de Gallo.
Why not? Actually, I'm pretty much open to the idea. But nonetheless, I think it would make it more difficult for these people politically to push for bolder decisions and for not only bold decisions, but creativity. The past people we had in the monetary cycle have been extremely creative. The people before that, I'm thinking about the Trichet time, were much less creative. So it's not a given that following Draghi and what's going to happen at the end of 2019 and onwards, we'll have this creativity around the answers. Maybe eventually, at times of very severe crisis, we will have a response, as we always have. But I would say I'm a bit worried that the ECB is going to be very slow to react, which is basically what it has always been said of the ECB, but not always been fair when we think about Draghi, Constantio, and Pratt, where they have been relatively bold in the moves and relatively creative in the solutions that they have brought forward. So I would say this is a big deal, and we'll have to pay a lot of attention on the new people that will be in charge going forward.
Thank you, Sami. So quite a difficult cocktail for monetary policy in the euro area going forward. We have dangerous external risks raising their head. We have personality changes, some key players that have been very bold to act in the past, leaving the executive board. We have a reluctance from members that have the fiscal space and the macroeconomic ammunition to support the recovery, not willing to use it. And we may even have trade tensions directly affecting Europe. Let's hope I'm proven wrong there. But it is quite a challenging environment going forward. Thank you very much for joining us today. We have to return to these issues in the next podcast. It'd be good to have you back again to talk about this, to see how the ECB has been progressing in the meantime. But for now, thank you very much for your time, and thank you to all of our listeners for listening to today's episode. Next episode will be on the OMFEF channel on iTunes next Tuesday. So thank you very much, everyone, and thank you, Sami, for joining me.